Good morning. This is the KUNM Collins Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks for joining us. Today we're talking about the fuel spill at Kirtland Air Force Base and efforts to clean that spill up. Estimates are that 8 million gallons of fuel leaked into the ground from a leaky pipe over a period of decades. We'll be taking your calls. The number to call locally here in Albuquerque is 277-5866. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. We'll take your emails, and that email address is collinshow@kunm.org. We also have an area for online comments. For those of you who are listening online or want to check out our website, you can post comments on the link for this show, which is on our homepage right now, kunm.org. We've got several folks joining to participate in this conversation. First off this morning, Tom Berardinelli. He is the 377th Air Base Wing Director of Staff at Kirtland Air Force Base. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Happy to be here.
Great. We'll also be joined later this hour by Jim Davis with the New Mexico Environment Department and Rick Sheehan with the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority. They'll be joining us a little bit later this hour. We'll also be joined by Bruce Thompson. He is director of the UNM Water Resources Program. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation this morning, 277-5866 is the number to call. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. Mr. Berardinelli, let's start. I want to start off with asking you, what is it that we do not know about this fuel plume?
We don't completely know the extent of the plume yet. We do know quite a bit. We know fairly accurately where the liquid portion of this is. We know where the origin was, clearly, we know what constituents and contaminants are part of the plume. We don't know the northeasternmost reach of the plume, and that is what we're in the process of doing right now, which is adding additional ground monitoring wells to completely define that plume. I would add that our defining the plume or determining where the plume is, though, doesn't prevent us from doing things that get after the plume right now. There are things that we know that we can do right now based on the information we have from the 78 ground monitoring wells and the 35 soil vapor monitoring wells that we've installed. We have a pretty good amount of information on the thickness of the plume and where we can best attack it. And so in addition to continuing the characterization, we have been operating what we call soil vapor extraction wells for almost 8 years now, and we'll be increasing the capability of that technology within the next several months.
So when you mentioned earlier, I'm going to go back and touch on a couple things you mentioned for folks who may not be as familiar with this topic. You mentioned the liquid portion, and you also mentioned soil vapor extraction. Can you break that down and explain about the different forms in which this contamination exists right now?
Sure. The plume itself is really exists in three different states. There's the actual liquid fuel, and often you'll hear the term referred to as LNAPL, the liquid non-aqueous petroleum product. That's the actual fuel that's actually floating on the water table that made its way down through the soil. Also, like any fuel, if you were to leave the gas cap off a can of gas in your garage, it evaporates. There's vapor. And so a portion of this plume is in a vapor state that is between that LNAPL and the surface. And then just as if you were to put a dropper of oil into a glass of water, it floats, but you would also see that there are portions of it that dissolve to a certain extent. And so there is a dissolved phase of this plume. One thing I'd like to go back, and it may be helpful. I think some people often ask, well, if this thing was discovered in 1999 and it's 8 million gallons, how could you not know that you had this fuel leaking? And it's a good question. It's a question I had.
It was one I was going to ask you.
I think it would be helpful to spend a minute or two explaining that. The fuel that came into Kirtland Air Force Base at the time, it came in both in trucks and rail cars.
Starting in the 1950s?
Yes.
Right. When this pipe, that was when the pipe was built, correct?
In the early 50s. And the rail cars and the trucks would come into what was an offloading rack. It would take the fuel out of the rail car or the truck and through a vacuum system deliver to a storage tank. The pipes that went underground to the storage tank also went underneath the rail lines and the road areas where these vehicles would offload the fuel. There was a certain amount of that fuel pools in the pipe after the vacuum is taken off, and in a small amount. It's such a small amount that it was within the tolerance of how you measure an input and an output to determine if you have
in the sense that you're saying that folks at that time with their inventory of fuel, that it was leaking at such a slow rate that it was unnoticeable?
That's correct. And so you take that over what could have been, and we really won't know exactly when this started, but a 30 to 40 year period, where we pumped probably almost close to a billion gallons of fuel in that time frame. The 8 million gallon is an estimate.
That was the New Mexico Environment Department,
yeah.
Right?
And it's based on a formula they use called EPA tanks, which determines what fuel may have been able to make it into the ground.
What is Kirtland's estimate of the total amount of leaked fuel?
Well, we don't necessarily dispute that amount. And we will really never know how much, and there really is no exact way to determine. And the exact amount itself doesn't necessarily, the knowledge of what that amount is, doesn't necessarily contribute to what we can do to remediate it. So we don't necessarily dispute what that amount is. We consider it an estimate, and given the time frame, it's a little bit less than 1% of the total amount of fuel that was pumped over, if you estimated it, that it began in the late 50s or early 60s.
So let me ask another question. Why, with the discovery of this leak in 1999, there are some critics of the base's efforts to clean up this spill who have said that nothing has been done over 12 years to pull any of that liquid fuel off of the surface of the aquifer. Why so long?
I wouldn't say that we haven't been doing anything. It is a good question. One of the challenges is as we learn more about this plume, and especially as someone might enter into this discussion and see what we know now, that often is the question. One of the things we have to remember is we didn't know much in 1999. We didn't know anything in 1999 until the leak was discovered. It was initially discovered by the operators of that offloading area. They saw stained soil, and that began the normal process that we would respond to. Initially, it was thought to be a spill, but as they excavated the soil, they saw that it was more than that. It was reported to the Environment Department at the time, and that fuel offloading rack was immediately taken out of service. So there has not been an additional source to this leak since 1999 when it was taken out of service, and we've completely replaced that infrastructure with infrastructure now that's vaulted above ground, inspectable, so this couldn't happen again. So from 1999 to about 2004, this investigation began, and there were monitoring wells that were installed to investigate the extent of it in the soil. And initially, it was believed to be confined to the soil. And so in...
And by that you mean confined to soil and not in the aquifer.
Correct.
Where the water table begins.
Correct. In this area of the aquifer is approximately, the surface of the aquifer is approximately 500 feet below the ground level. And the area between the surface and the aquifer is often referred to as the vadose zone. I'm just going to call it soil to keep it simple.
Thank you.
So initially, and remember, we had no idea at that time how long this may have been going on. So the initial investigation was of the soil. It was an approved investigation by the Environment Department. And in 2004, it was determined that we would begin the remediation of this soil contamination with a soil vapor extraction system. And so that was initiated in 2004.
And was that before the water contamination was discovered?
Yes, right. At that time, it was only believed to be confined to the soil. And so in the 2007 time frame, our staff hydrologist at Kirtland had noticed some things in the soil vapor monitoring wells that did not make sense to him if this were something that were shallow and confined to the soil. And so we began to install ground monitoring wells at that time. And it was in the spring of 2007 that it was determined to be on the water table based on the ground monitoring wells that were on Kirtland. With that knowledge, we began walking out the ground monitoring wells, and in late 2007, it was discovered to be that it had migrated off the installation, off the base, onto the...
So by walking out wells, you're talking about extending out the network of wells further and further away from the leak site.
Correct.
To determine.
To determine. And I think it's important to understand that you'll hear me probably in the course of this show use the word iterative frequently. This is an iterative process. You don't know what you don't know. And so, and especially when it's 500 feet below the surface, the only way you learn is to put these monitoring wells in the ground. You want to put them in the right spot, too. And so as we gather information, that informs us about, well, where do we go next? And so that's what we've been doing in the characterization phase. Now, starting in 2004, we began operating the soil vapor extraction systems that to date have pulled out about 400,000 gallons. Those are a very beginning intermediate measure, and we will increase that amount considerably when we install the newer units.
Tom Berardinelli is the 377th Air Base Wing Director of Staff at Kirtland Air Force Base. We're talking about the fuel spill at Kirtland and efforts to clean up that spill. We're also joined this morning by Rick Sheehan. He is with the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority. He is a water quality hydrologist. And also joining us, Bruce Thompson. He is the director of the UNM Water Resources Program. He's also a Regents Professor of Civil Engineering. Good morning to you both. Thanks for joining us today. I want to quickly tell the number for our listeners so that they can participate in this conversation this morning. 277-5866 is the number to call to bring your comments, questions to the panel this morning. We can also take your toll-free calls, 877-899-5866. You can send emails to callinshow@kunm.org, or you can post your comments online at kunm.org. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with the additional members of our panel.
Support comes from Saggio's, homemade real Italian pizza, calzones, pasta, salads, and desserts, serving Albuquerque and the UNM community since 1968. Saggio's encourages support of public radio KUNM on Cornell Southeast across from UNM and at Saggio's.com.
KUNM programming is supported by the law firm of Rothstein, Donatelli, Hughes, Dahlstrom, Schoenberg, and Bienvenue, with offices in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Phoenix since 1976. For information, RothsteinLaw.com.
The UNM Bookstore, conveniently located on Central and Cornell, is your one-stop community bookstore. More than just textbooks, the UNM Bookstore features an in-store coffee shop and technology store, a large selection of local interest and academic titles, as well as the latest bestsellers, office supplies, and exclusive Lobo apparel and merchandise. For more info, call 277-5452 or log on to bookstore.unm.edu. A message from the tax-exempt UNM Bookstore.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Today we're talking about the fuel spill at Kirtland Air Force Base and efforts to clean up that spill. We have representatives from Kirtland Air Force Base and the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority, also the UNM Water Resources Program, with us right now. We'll also be joined shortly by Jim Davis. He is with the New Mexico Environment Department. He'll be joining us by phone from Santa Fe. I do want to take a call. We have Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. Good morning to your guests. This contaminating disaster has been going on for decades through survey studies, checking on wells, and so forth. Millions of dollars have been spent in this disaster. We've learned in the 21st century that there's profit to be made in disasters. There's a saying in the military, poor young soldiers die to make old rich men richer. Is this what's going on with this disaster? Of the millions of dollars spent, who is profiting from this? And what kind of chemicals are in this contamination, like beryllium and so forth? Thank you.
Mr. Bardinelli, can you respond to both questions about the military and about the contaminants that the fuel contained?
I'm not certain there was a question in there about the military. We take very seriously our responsibilities, whether that's protecting this nation and with the hundreds of thousands of soldiers and sailors and airmen that are doing that right now, and many that have been assigned to Kirtland Air Force Base that have died to do that. As far as what's in the fuel, it's a petroleum compound. There is what we would call BTEX, which is and I think I'm gonna try this on the surface, and then I'm gonna defer to Bruce, who is far more knowledgeable on this. But
well, maybe I'll narrow narrow it a little bit to the conversation about ethylene dibromide.
Sure.
Did I say that correctly?
Yes.
That is the compound that dissolves into, or is at least one of the compounds that dissolves
Correct.
Into water and is highly toxic.
Correct. Well, you know, these are fuel products, so any of them are toxic. Most of the products, the benzene, the toluene, the ethylene, the xylene, are fairly stable in this plume and have stayed fairly close to where the liquid phase is. And they are also very susceptible to biodegradation, and we can see that that's effective. So those constituents have been very stable, and they do not appear to be moving. I remember I spoke earlier that there's a dissolve phase to this. Well, the EDB that you mentioned before is a lead scavenger that was placed in fuel, both aviation and gasoline, when we had leaded fuel. We stopped using that in the 80s, but it was part of the fuel that leaked in.
So this is a legacy compound,
sure,
from older forms of fuel.
Right. It is a bad actor, and it is not as susceptible to the biodegradation, and so it has a tendency in this dissolve phase to migrate with the groundwater, and so it is the compound of most concern to us as we move forward with the remediation, and I'll defer to Bruce on.
Bruce Thompson with the UNM Water Resources Program. Can you talk a little bit about the movement of this contaminant EDB, the ethylene dibromide, in the water table underneath Albuquerque? How close is this plume? At least what knowledge do we have about how close this contamination is to sources of drinking water for southeastern portions of Albuquerque?
Mm-hmm. Well, ethylene dibromide is one of the bad actors, as Mr. Berard nearly said, in part because it's it doesn't interact much with the soil and it's not readily biodegradable. So therefore, it moves with the groundwater. And I don't know exactly how far, but it's moved several thousand feet from the source. But I think the best information we have to date, which is, I will admit, is absolutely incomplete, the best information is that it's still some distance, perhaps 1,000 feet or more, from the nearest well it's owned by the Water Utility Authority.
And so does that mean it's moved several thousand feet over a period of decades?
50 or 60 years.
Right. So I want to go to Rick Sheehan with the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority. One of the points that Dave McCoy made in an interview that we aired earlier this morning was that the pumping activities of the water authority, the pumping of water up from very deep source wells, is actually drawing the contamination towards the wells. Can you respond to that and explain?
Sure. What Mr. McCoy is referring to, definitely there's a cone of depression that has been very obvious in the Albuquerque groundwater basin for several years, especially since the 60s and 70s.
And that's cone of depression, meaning that the water table is lower around a well, right?
That's correct. And in fact, entire a well field and basically all the wells in the northeast part of town have been pumping for several decades. Would like to point out, although there is still a cone of depression, the use of surface water, the Rio Grande, has seen some results in the successful water. Water table rising over the last few years since 2009. So we're seeing sort of a decline in the cone of depression. Certainly it is a concern that the flow of the jet fuel is headed toward, the Ridgecrest well. But at the same time, it's a very productive zone of the aquifer. It has a low arsenic content. So it's a good spot for us to keep drilling at this point.
We have an email question from Veronica, and she has a question for you water hydrologists. Will the contaminants hit the Ridgecrest well? You mentioned it's well number three, or Kirtland supply well number three. She wants to know, is that something that is inevitable? Is that going to happen?
I don't know. I think Mr. Biardinelli can probably respond to the Kirtland well. At this point, with the amount of remediation occurring, if nothing happened at this point, it's very well possible they could hit the well field. But that's not the plan.
Is it possible that it could hit the well field despite activities to stop the spread of contaminants? Tell the future, Rick. Sorry.
I wish I could. I wish they'd make this all easy for all of us right now.
Bruce, what are your thoughts on this projection of contamination of drinking water wells in the Ridgecrest area?
Well, remember, it's been in the ground for 50 or 60 years, and it's moved several thousand feet. It's really moving very, very slowly. It's extremely difficult to project into the future. Once remediation activities are started, in almost certainty that the plume will retract, and the chances of it impacting either the Kirtland supply wells or the authority's supply wells diminishes considerably.
Let's take a few more calls. Glenn in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. You asked a question of the Colonel, which I don't think was answered, and I would like to hear an answer. Why have there not been wells drilled into the liquid portion of the plume to not only extract fuel but to relieve pressure on the outward expansion of the plume? Second question, and then I'll hang up. What toxic materials are left in the soil and potentially in the water at the completion of the vapor recovery process and or the liquid recovery process? And what remediation or neutralization processes are being planned to take care of those toxic materials left behind?
Mr. Berardinelli.
I'll take the first question on drilling wells into the liquid portion of the plume. Let me start by saying we're going to use the term wells here many times as we talk about this, and there are really several types of wells. So let me talk about what those are first, and that may help as I
briefly, so we can get as right. many calls in as
the,
possible.
There are monitoring wells that go into the soil. There are monitoring wells that go into the water. So those are telling us what's going on down there. We then have wells that are specific for extraction, either to pump and treat or for soil vapor extraction. And then you have the production wells, which are the Ridcrest and the Kirtland wells. We do have ground monitoring wells. We have 78 of them that go into the aquifer, both on and off the base. So we do have wells down there that are investigating that. What the caller may be referring to is a pump and treat system, which is a way to treat this type of contamination. There is debate on how effective that is, and we have a work plan that we have submitted to the Environment Department to use this on the leading edge of the plume as a potential containment system. At this point, there is there's a difference of opinion among some very educated and knowledgeable hydrologists on whether that would be effective or whether that would hurt the remediation. And so right now, we've been allowed to drill that well. Going any further has been held off, and we're focusing primarily now on the soil vapor extraction system.
And the soil vapor extraction system, I'm just going to quickly describe what that is. You correct
sure.
me if I've got it right, but it is taking the vapor that is turning into a gaseous form off of the liquid fuel in the soil and burning that as it comes up out of the ground.
That's correct.
There's
going to be a portion of this plume that will always be in a vapor state. And so the soil vapor extraction goes after that, and you will continuously be creating vapor.
Well, it sounded a little bit like the previous caller's question was, I mean, is it, you were saying there's disagreement. So the disagreement is about whether it's possible to pump the liquid fuel off of the top of the aquifer. Bruce Thompson.
Yeah, in principle, it sounds very obvious. Sink a well right in the center.
Absolutely, it sounds really obvious.
Of the phase-separated liquid, of the free product that's floating on the water table. But in practice, it's really difficult. That stuff does not flow. The petroleum hydrocarbon, the phase-separated liquid, does not behave like you would expect. You'd have to create a cone of depression. In order to create a cone of depression, you have to pump a huge volume of water because of the aquifer properties. So it sounds very obvious, it sounds real simple, and in practice it's very difficult, perhaps not even possible with the situation they've got there.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Doug in Albuquerque. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm finding, first of all, that your broadcast is hard to hear because suddenly when this important subject comes on the air, I had to turn my volume from 10 to 36 just to hear it.
We have been informed about the level of broadcast, and we have our chief engineer working on that. Do you have a question for the panel today?
Yes. I was wondering if Bruce Thompson or Mr. Bertinelli has ever taken a sponge and gotten oil or fuel on it and tried to clean that sponge out. You never can get rid of the smell. It's the hydrocarbons are always there. And I'd like to know what's going to happen. Hopefully, 2,000 years from now, our great 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 grandchildren are going to be living here. And how are they going to deal with this? And where are they going to get their drinking water supply once? You know, it moves in 2,000 years, it'll move maybe a mile. So, and hopefully people will still be living in Albuquerque.
Bruce Thompson.
Yeah, the caller is referring to what's sometimes described as a smear zone. And, you know, hydrocarbons, gasoline and diesel and jet fuel are composed of thousands of compounds. And there are basically six that are regulated, the benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylenes, and ethylene dibromide. The rest of the compounds are either relatively non-toxic, and we have lots of experience with the things that ethanes and stuff like that, or they just stick to the soil and don't go anywhere. Now, in 2,000 years, you know, my guess is most of that stuff will be gone just through natural attenuation, dilution, and biodegradation.
Let's take Dave in Albuquerque. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, the biodegradation, we're at 5,200 feet elevation, extremely low levels of oxygen, and only at the periphery, perhaps 5 parts per million. How do you expect biodegradation to have any effect whatsoever on the liquid portion of the fuel? And also, does Kirtland Air Force Base or Shaw Environmental intend to remove a single gallon in 2012 of the liquid portion of the plume? Thank you.
Bruce first, and then we'll go to Mr. Bardinelli. Bruce Thompson with the UNM Water Resources Program.
There, biodegradation happens both aerobically and anaerobically. 5 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen is plenty if you're dealing with microgram per liter concentrations of bent BTEX.
Can I try to translate that?
Yes.
Does that mean you're saying there's enough oxygen in the soil?
Yes.
Okay.
And the SVE, the soil vapor extraction process, is going to aerate the heck out of the soil. I'd also like to point out, if Mr. Davis is on still online.
He'll be joining us in just about a minute.
He can attest to the fact that there's something on the order of 3,000 sites in New Mexico similar to this, similar compounds, much smaller magnitude, but perhaps two-thirds, three-quarters of those sites have been successfully remediated to below standards.
Mr. Bardinelli, the question about removal of a gallon or more of liquid fuel during 2012.
We will remove the equivalent of that through the vapor. Now,
do you have an estimate of what the quantity in gallons of vapor might come out this year?
Currently, what we remove an equivalent of fuel with the current system, it takes out about per unit, and we have 4 units that are operating. About when it is in its optimal position, approximately 200 gallons a day.
Are all of these locations in an optimal location?
No,
like you say?
No, and that's what this new system will do. It is drilled so that the wells go to the above the thickest portion of the plume where the vapors are stronger. Now, are you removing the liquid that's floating on the fuel by pumping it out of the ground? No, you're not. But what you are doing is that liquid is continuously creating vapor, and you are removing that. And so as you remove it, it equalizes and then creates vapor. So you are essentially removing the fuel.
We are talking about the fuel spill at Kirtland Air Force Base. The panel is taking your calls this morning. The number is 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. You can send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org. You can also post comments on our website, kunm.org. We are also have Jim Davis with us at this point this morning. He is the director of the Resource Protection Division of the New Mexico Environment Department. Good morning, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Elaine.
So we've been talking here about, you know, different types of contaminants and the different processes that the folks at Kirtland are using to try to clean up this spill. Recently, your department wrote a letter saying that Kirtland's efforts were inadequate. Can you explain this critique of Kirtland's efforts and what you're expecting to see in the future?
Sure, Elaine. That letter, I think, went out 2 weeks ago approximately, something like that.
Yeah, I think it was the 13th, right? So it's about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to bother you. Are you on a speakerphone? Could I get you to pick up your handset so we can hear you better?
Yes,
perfect.
Sure.
Thank you.
Is this better?
That is brilliant. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Yeah, the letter, what we did is we asked the Air Force to drill wells in both the shallow, intermediate, and deep zones of the aquifer. And by that I mean about 100 deep being about 100 feet below the surface of the aquifer, intermediate about 50 feet, and shallow being right at the interface. Because what we're interested in is seeing how deep the contamination is moving into the aquifer. So they had, and we had proposed to the Air Force prior to that, or in conversation, to do this just at a shallow depth, but we decided later that they should go both intermediate and deep, which is the approach that had been used in the other 78 groundwater monitoring wells that Tom Berardinelli has talked about. So the idea that it was inadequate or incomplete perhaps is a better way to say it, because again, as Tom indicated, this is an iterative process, and as we learn what is happening with the dynamics of the plume, we adjust our approach accordingly. So I think in a nutshell, that pretty much explains what we were trying to get at in the letter.
Let's take another call from another Jim calling from Albuquerque. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a couple observations from what I've heard and then a couple questions. It seems to me that in the way this is being presented, the various people on your panel are saying distinct things that seem to tell a story, but they don't connect the dots to illuminate a process. Mr. Berardinelli said early on that it was believed 10, 20, 30 years ago, believed that there was not much leakage there. And that in itself should really be given some thought, because it doesn't say much about who the people were, what they dismissed, what could have been revealed at the moment, whoever believed what then. 30 years ago. Going back to what the university professor said, also giving timelines 50, 60 years, implying that the plume is moving very slowly. It's an entirely different process for how long it takes that stuff to go through the soil, and then when it reaches the aquifer, how quickly it moves out into the aquifer horizontally, out, east, west, north, south. Entirely different process. That can be characterized generally simply from good science. Simply from good science. They have said that the plume is moving very, very slowly. They don't know how fast it's moving. It's moved a quarter of the way to the Ridgecrest well in about the last year.
Is that, Bruce Thompson, is Jim's comment about the speed of the movement of this plume, is that what you have found?
You know, I haven't looked at that and reached that conclusion.
Mr. Berardinelli.
I would just say that we're not counting in what we're doing right now. We're not counting on the plume not moving quickly. We understand that the dissolve phase will move with the aquifer. Now, how fast
do those dissolved contaminants move faster than the fuel in the soil? The way that Jim implies.
I don't know that you can say that. Yeah. There's too many uncertainties.
It's unknown.
But, part of this is it's 500 feet below the ground. And in 1999, to see a stain in the soil and and interpolate that to everything we know right now, I don't know how you do that. There's still a lot we don't know. That's why we are going to continue with the characterization.
Characterization, you mean by studying the size of the plume?
Right, correct. By installing additional ground wells to determine where the northeasternmost reaches of this are. That tells us what the plume is. That doesn't affect, though, what we have been doing and what we are about to do with this larger scale soil vapor extraction system. We know what we need to know for that system to be effective and to get it in, and it will have It will have a beneficial effect in terms of the remediation of the plume.
Is there any kind of research going on to look at how these contaminants move in water to kind of recreate an aquifer-type scenario in a research experimental context to be able to gather information in a shorter term? Since it sounds like you don't know where the edge of the plume is, therefore it's hard to measure the movement of the plume.
There are some models, but they're incomplete. I think the one thing that we should all understand is that there, although there is subsurface fuel contamination all over the country, there are not very many situations like this one. And so we are all learning a lot with each of those ground monitoring wells that we put in and each piece of data that we come out. But I'll defer to Bruce in terms of the modeling or what we can learn from that.
Elaine, let me use an analogy that the groundwater hydrologists frequently use, and that is trying to predict what's going on underground is like lying on your back looking at the sky through the tube of toilet paper and trying to predict the weather next week. It's very spotty information, and you're trying to extrapolate from, in this case, 78 wells.
Let's take another call. Henry is calling us from Massachusetts. Good morning, Henry. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I have several questions and some comments. Bruce Thompson had mentioned that the plume has moved 1,000 feet over the course of many years, but as it moves closer to the Ridgecrest wells, it will accelerate. The dissolved portion of the plume is much, much larger than the liquid portion, probably three times larger. So that is an indication that the plume is moving. It's moving rapidly. The dissolved portion has EDB. I was in Albuquerque 2 weeks ago, and I heard Colonel Connolly state that he has no plans, the military has no plans for removing any portion of the dissolved plume. Once that dissolved plume hits the wells, the Ridgecrest wells, and more quickly it'll hit the Kirtland Air Force Base wells, because it's only 1,000 feet from that, or 500 feet, it'll be all over for the city. There'll be a crisis. In Kindergarten 101, we learned that if you make a mess, you clean it up. Colonel Connolly indicated several times that we own the problem. There's been no remediation in 15 years. I would ask the colonel, I would ask the committee, why? It seems to me that it's a factor of cost. What the city needs to do, the Water Utility Authority, New Mexico Environment Department, they need to force the military to set serious money aside, $500+ million to build a water treatment plant, have an independent team of experts, because these experts are engaged in an obfuscation and doublespeak, and the city infrastructure will be threatened. They have a citizen advisory committee, which to me appears to be apologists for the military. They also have Shaw Environmental, and they have done, again, no remediation, not 1 gallon of liquid fuel, not 1 gallon of the dissolved portion will ever be removed. So I ask the committee, what will they do when the dissolved portion of the plume, they don't even know how extensive it is, reaches the wells? What is their plan?
Rick Sheehan with the Water Authority here in Albuquerque and Bernalillo County. Is there a plan in place for if this contamination reaches the Ridgecrest well?
You know, we would, in the first scenario, is one, we get a detection of EDB, for example, the ethyl dibromide. One, we have to turn off the well and sample again and get another detection.
What does that mean for the authority, the water authority?
Well, depending on which well hits in the system, we sort of have to isolate that well at this point and shift around the knobs and all the switches and make sure we're no longer taking in that water to
How big of a deal would that be? I mean, there was a comment in an Albuquerque Journal article from folks at your department saying there is no way currently to simply shut down the wells and still provide service.
In the short term, it's manageable. In the long term, it's not. An alternative to the water supply that is fed by the Ridgecrest well field would have to be found.
I'd like to ask to pass a question on to Jim Davis from the New Mexico Environment Department. He's joining us by phone from Santa Fe. Jim, we had an email question wanting to know about the Air Force's interim measures plan that your department ordered 2 years ago. A woman named Veronica Cruz asks, when will that plan be submitted to you? Can you give us an update on that relationship?
Sure. The Air Force did submit the interim measures plan to the Environment Department, but I think it was Tom Berardinelli earlier that indicated to you there's some scientific and technical debate surrounding the best way to address this plume with respect to what's called euphemistically a pump and treat system. And that interim measures plan initially had proposed to put in wells at the what we would call the toe of the plume and the toe of the benzene plume, the BTEX plume, in order to interrupt its movement, if you will, or interrupt the movement of EDB. And what we're concerned about, and where there's legitimate technical debate, is would that actually make the situation better, or could it inadvertently make the situation worse by pulling more of the contaminant mass in the direction of those wells? So currently what we've basically done is we've been working with the Air Force since last summer to redirect efforts to this much enhanced and enlarged soil vapor extraction system, which has been referred to a couple of times. That doesn't mean that we've taken other options or technologies off the table, but what we want to do initially is attack this at the center of the contaminant mass, where the estimates are perhaps as much as 75% of the total contaminant mass is in what we would call the heel of the plume. If you can visualize your foot, the majority of the contaminant mass is in what we would call the heel or the source area of the plume, and then it extends out to the toe of the plume. What we don't want to do is inadvertently make that situation worse by pulling a significant portion of that contaminant mass throughout that footprint and therefore making it more difficult to remediate. So what we want to do initially is get the soil vapor extraction wells. They're 6-inch diameter, two wells, right in the center of the contaminant mass. We want to get that system up and running and suck like crazy on the vapor, at the same time monitoring everything to see how the plume responds. At that point, then we'll have additional data to decide what the next step should be.
Bruce Thompson with the UNM Water Resources Program.
Elaine, this discussion that Mr. Davis is talking about is exactly the point that I think that is important for the public to recognize. Several of the callers have expressed concern that the Air Force is dragging their feet or something like that. And that's not the case. Not now. It might have been the case 10 years ago. I'm not going to talk about that. But right now, we have to be very careful that the actions we take use the best available information, which is incomplete and will always be incomplete. So we have to take the best action, and we have to be careful that we don't exacerbate the problem.
So for folks who are deeply concerned about what the Air Force is doing, there have been some public meetings. Will there be more? And what are methods for incorporating what you would say maybe is a broad base of knowledge and study and information about these kinds of things with folks who may not be affiliated with the university or with the city or the state, how to kind of utilize the brain power of a wide source of people? Tom Berardinelli, are there plans for that?
Absolutely. Meaningful public participation in this process is absolutely essential to the success of this. We, at a minimum, we do 6 public meetings a year, 4 specifically with our Citizens Advisory Board, and 2 that we do jointly with DOE. In addition to that, we have been and will continue to be meeting with the neighborhood associations in the areas that are closest to this, primarily Siesta Hills, Elder Homestead, and the Trumbull area. We have gone door to door where we have drilled. We will continue to do that. We will continue to meet with and present updates to the Water Utility Authority Board and any others that would ask us to do this. All information on this plume is posted on our public website. There's no information on this that is not available to the public. It's a dearth of information. There's a lot.
I think folks, you know, I have been reading, and there are folks who are concerned that there is information that's not available to the public, and folks have filed FOIA requests, and so.
Well, it seems
there's got to be information that you're not making available to the public to a certain extent.
Well, all of the quarterly reports that we publish on this are immediately, they're delivered to the New Mexico Environment Department and within minutes are posted on our website and the NMED website. There's no other information that we're holding that's not in those quarterly reports. Now, in between those quarterly reports, and as we collaborate with the many state, city agencies that are involved with this, we do hold technical meetings, collaborative meetings, working groups with both the New Mexico Environment Department and others that involve the Water Utility Authority, the Veterans Administration, the State Engineer, the New Mexico Environment Department, EPA Region 6, where we discuss, as we do one thing, how does it affect something else and what help do we need? So if we're going to require additional wells, we're working very closely with the Albuquerque Environmental and Health Department. We're working very closely with the city on the permits that we need to get in there. So there is a lot of collaboration that goes on. Not all of that is done in public. However, any result of that is either in a public meeting or in reports that are available to the public. So there's really nothing that we're hiding. I would also add that, you know, Kirtland wears two hats on this to some degree. One, yes, we created this and we are responsible for cleaning it up, and the most senior level of the Air Force leadership is committed to that. The second is we operate a production well that serves the people that live and work on Kirtland Air Force Base. And so we have a responsibility, just like the Water Utility Authority does, to ensure that we provide safe drinking water to the folks that use that. I will say now, and we've been doing this for several years now, we've been testing those wells in an increased frequency. We've been funding additional testing to the Water Utility Authority to test their wells. There is no evidence of any of these contaminants in those Ridgecrest wells or the Kirtland well.
Or the VA wells. There was a question about VA wells also.
The VA wells have had occasionally had a screening detection, but on further investigation in those wells, there's been no detection of the actual constituents.
So what I expected and what has been accurate was that we would have many more calls than we have time to take during this show with you folks. And so I want to say that I would like to have you all back perhaps in a month or two's time to give an update on information, what the process, you know, how the new technology is working for you folks at Kirtland, what new information Bruce, you may have, or Rick from the Water Authority, also Jim Davis from the New Mexico Environment Department. We will be continuing to talk about this. Will you all come back?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely.
Great. So this has been the KUNM Call-In Show. If you missed a portion of this show on talking about the fuel spill at Kirtland Air Force Base, you can find it online at KUNM.org. Just give me about 10 minutes to post the audio for you. Joining us this morning, we had Jim Davis from the New Mexico Environment Department, Rick Sheehan from the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority, Tom Berardinelli joined us from Kirtland Air Force Base, and Bruce Thompson from the UNM Water Resources Program. Again, you can find this audio online. We'll also take your emails with comments and topic suggestions for the show. That address is callinshow@kunm.org. We also have a new tool on our website. It's a comment area on these call-in show posts. We encourage you to post your thoughts and comments about the show there online. We do want to hear what you think. Engineering today, Roman Garcia. We also had Michael Hess screening your calls. Andy Lyman is our news intern. And thanks also to Conservation Beat reporter Cecil Overgaard for her assistance in prepping for this show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. The KUNM Call-In Show will be back next Thursday morning at 8 o'clock here on KUNM.